My castaway this week is a surgeon and a painter. Medicine and art meet in a man who's one of this country's pioneers of transplant surgery. His interest in the subject began in the 1950s when his beliefs kept him poor, often derided, but nonetheless determined. 40 years on, he can look back on a career that's included 1,500 kidney and 1,000 liver transplants. At the same time, he's drawn closer to his patients and his colleagues through his love of painting. His portraits of them have been the subject of several public exhibitions. "I found painting to have many similar features to surgery," he says, citing careful planning, intense effort and discipline as three of the things both need to be successful. He is Sir Roy Khan. There is, though, Sir Roy, as you've pointed out, an essential difference between the two, which is that if you don't like the painting, you can throw it away.
Yes, and that's a good thing to do with a bad painting, I think.
But how much are you still moved by the loss of a patient?
I don't think that changes at all. I think from the very beginning as a medical student and throughout one's career, if a patient dies, it's always a tragedy. And one's always looking at oneself for mistakes one might have made or alternative treatments that might have been better. So one has a feeling of regret for the sadness of the loss of the patient, but also a self-inquisition as to what couldn't it have been done better.
You've gone further than that before. I mean, you've talked about having a sense of devastation every time it happens. I'm just amazed that over the years you haven't sort of come to terms with it. And
I think the devastation is when a death occurs totally unexpected. I think somebody who has a fatal disease which goes to its conclusion, it's not quite the same. It's still a tragedy, but it's not the same as the unexpected, especially in a young person.
So it's always with you, is it? When you go home at night, if you go out to dinner or whatever, you are always thinking, I wonder how they're doing. Do you pause to ring up? Do you?
It depends on the case, and I'm always happy to speak to patients who've done well, especially many years after a transplant operation. But I can also easily bring back the image of patients who had hoped to do well and their relatives who trusted in me and where I had failed, and I can see that as well, and that is a sadness.
I'm sure it must be the faces of the relatives of the deceased, yes. Presumably.
And the child that says, you know, please do your best, doctor, and if you fail. So I think it is a personal thing, and I think this is something that's shared by all doctors.
So it's an emotional business, which is really one of the reasons, isn't it, that you've taken to painting your patients, because it helps you, perhaps it's therapeutic for you, come to terms with that kind of...
A lot of people have said it's therapeutic to me, and it may be. I started to paint my work and my patients when I had contact and friendship established with John Bellany, who's a very distinguished painter, who was a patient of ours in Addenbrookes. And after his transplant operations, he did 60 paintings of himself mainly, often in the guise of a hero, particularly a tortured hero. Many of his paintings look like Saint Sebastian, he, and the doctors, the torturers, firing their darts into him. And he gave me some lessons, and one of the lessons was to paint him. And I painted him. I saw him as an extremely sick man, just able to sit in a chair and hold a glass of milk, which wasn't a Saint Sebastian representation at all. And it struck me that the difference in the way one looks at an image depends very much from where you're sitting. And it also occurred to me that although I'm not a professional painter, I did have a new subject. Nobody had ever painted transplantation before because it didn't exist. So it has opened up a new world for me in terms of my painting.
Tell me about your first record.
Well, the first record is the Pathetique Sonata of Beethoven, and that was one of the first pieces of classical music that I heard played by a master at school when I was about 7 or 8. And it got me interested in music, listening to it for the sake of listening. And it is a very well-known piece of music, but that doesn't in any way detract from it as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
part of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 8, The Pathétique, played by Walter Gieseking. Do you play music, Sir Roy, when you're operating?
I do, not always, but I started because we had a theatre sister who used to shout, and that upset me when I was operating. I couldn't concentrate on what I was doing. And I brought in some music, mainly chamber music, and she seemed to like it, and everybody else did.
And she shut up?
And she did, yes.
But what about your patients? I mean, do you think they worry about your listening to music, perhaps not totally concentrating on them?
It does produce an air of calm and particularly stops people getting tense and with jangled nerves, which can happen and is always to the detriment of the patient.
And in any case, the patient has no idea what's going on anyway.
Well, there was one case where a patient did know what was going on to the extent of identifying the music, although not suffering from any memory of pain or trauma, but she had a liver transplant, and I did have a record I brought in, which was the Berlioz Requiem, with tremendous dramatic chords and choruses. And the next day, when she had recovered sufficiently, I asked her how she felt, and she said she was doing quite well, still had a bit of pain in the tummy, and she said she couldn't get out of her head the music of the Berlioz Requiem, which she correctly identified, and I knew exactly why she had identified it.
She'd taken it in,
and it was there, and it seemed to me that I'd made rather an inappropriate choice of a requiem for somebody having a huge operation.
I want to ask you a bit more about your paintings, because particularly your paintings of children, I notice, your child patients, and you always put their names in the operation on, did you? That's so you can identify them, that's...
Well, no, to make them I show the paintings to the patients, of course, and sometimes give them copies. Too, I think, acknowledge the fact that they are very special people and they have been very courageous and going through the procedure. Maybe they had no choice, but still, it is a tough thing to go through, a huge operation like that. And children, little children, about 5 to 7 or 8, are terrified of hospitals. They've often had chronic disease. They've been in and out of hospitals since they can remember. The hospital visit is usually associated with painful injections, painful procedures, even operations and unpleasant medicines. And whenever they see a doctor, they cringe and they look so frightened and introverted. And I've found that if I do bring pencil and paper and sit down, they change almost dramatically because they know what this is about and they can do it too. And then we can become friends.
But you seem to capture that fear, that angst, that their eyes in your pictures, their eyes always look very big. Is that how you see them?
Yes, and also they do have very long eyelashes, which look beautiful. But when the child has been chronically ill, their eyelashes grow for reasons that are not very well understood. And they do look very beautiful, the eyelashes and the big eyes and the staring. But they do often also look very frightened.
But the drawing of them overcomes the fear and gives them
greater
confidence for the
operation.
When
you sit down with them, and I mean, I don't draw all my patients by any means because I just don't have the time, but when I do sit down with a patient, it's a marvellous way of getting to know them.
Record number 2.
Well, record number 2 is Joss White singing I Gave My Love a Cherry. Joss White was a Negro singer who suffered grievously when he was young. He was attacked by a racist who broke all the bones in his fingers, and he lived above this terrible handicap and became a wonderful guitarist and singer. And I used to sing his songs to my children, and one they used to like very much was I Gave My Love a Cherry, because the last bit is there's a child with no crying.
I gave my love a cherry that had no stone. I gave my love a chicken that had no bone. I told my love a story that had no end. I gave my
Josh White, I gave my love a cherry. Going back to your boyhood, Roy Kahn, was there ever a dilemma as to whether you'd be a painter or a doctor?
No, I don't think so. I did love painting ever since my earliest school days, and I was very lucky. I had very good teachers at school, particularly Francis Russell Flint, the son of William Russell Flint. But I always wanted to be a doctor, particularly a surgeon. I wanted to be a surgeon before I knew what surgery was.
And how soon did you want to be a transplant surgeon?
I had the idea of a transplantation when I was a medical student, and I didn't realize that there had already been some experimental work done in this, but it wasn't established at all. There was no transplantation for patients, except the beginning of identical twins in America. But I asked our chief physician, whose firm I was on, if one of my patients, who was about my age, who was dying of kidney disease, could have a grafted kidney, and he said no. And I asked why not, and I was told it can't be done. And I was nudged by one of my friends not to ask any more questions if I wanted to get a house job at Guy's, so I didn't ask any more questions. But that was the beginning of the idea.
You say he was your age, which was 16, wasn't it?
Well, I was more than 16 then because I was a clinical student, so I would have been about 20 then.
But when you began at Guy's, yes. You were 16. That was incredibly precocious, very young, wasn't it?
It was difficult because there were only a few of us from school direct. Most of the class were ex-service. The average age was 26, and so the few of us who'd come straight from school were very much treated as children and looked upon as children by the others.
But you mentioned that sort of dismissive attitude, this sort of professional discouragement for any idea of transplant surgery. That went on for a long time.
Oh, it still goes on.
Does it?
I think anything that's new in medicine is resisted by the profession. Anything that's new is unsettling.
But why back then? I mean, I think you were even discouraged by the Nobel Prize winner, Sir Peter Medawar, weren't you? You were told, no, you know, immunology cannot help with transplant surgery.
It wasn't quite like that. He gave a lecture and he had done the most wonderful experimental work on showing that if you transplanted skin, for instance, or feathers in chickens that had been joined as embryos, so their bloods mingled as embryos, that they would be accepted, and that was a way of overcoming rejection. And at the end of the lecture, which he gave in Oxford, one of the students asked him if there was any practical application for treatment of patients, and he paused for a moment and then said two words, absolutely none. But this struck me as very strange because he had shown that there was a way, although it wasn't one that was immediately practicable. And I went to see my boss then in Oxford, who was a friend of Medawar's, and said I'd like to work with him when I finished. He said, Medawar was a very busy man. He said, you go and learn how to do hernias and don't waste his time. So there wasn't very much encouragement, but I think lack of encouragement sometimes stimulates one.
But why not? Why do you think, then, if you're saying that, generally speaking, the medical profession is a bit blinkered about progress? Why is that the case?
I think it's not only the medical profession. I think it's human nature. If you're used to something and it works and it's not too bad as far as you're concerned, you don't want anybody rocking the boat. People who rock the boat are usually regarded as dangerous. They may, in fact, be dangerous. And it's best to suppress them.
You've been regarded as dangerous in your time, have you?
Oh, yes, I think probably still so.
More music.
Well, the next is part of the clarinet quintet of Brahms. The singing and beauty of the clarinet is, I think, one of the most wonderful passages in the music repertoire that I've heard.
Of Brahms' clarinet quintet in B minor, opus 115, played by Thea King with the Gabrieli String Quartet. Who was it then, Sir Roy, who gave you your first big break in the field of transplantation and when?
It was in 1958. I had a job at the Royal Free Hospital and the urologist there, John Hopewell, he introduced me to the man who ran the experimental institute of the College of Surgeons, David Sloan. And he was unlike most of the people that I'd come across in that he was very enthusiastic that work of this type, even though we didn't understand very much about immunology, should start and we should make some efforts in this direction. And he borrowed £100 from his accounts in his department, which enabled me to get started with research in kidney transplantation. And it was extraordinary that nearly 40 years later, he paid back, I think it was £1,200, which was what he reckoned was the £100 plus interest.
Why? Because he felt guilty.
Because he felt guilty about this, because it was unauthorized by the College of Surgeons. I was extremely lucky in that after one set of experiments using the approved technique of stopping rejection, which was irradiation at that time, I used an anti-leukemia drug, and it's one that's still used, or its derivative is Imuran, in stopping rejection. And this was the first time that it was possible to prevent rejection of organs using a chemical.
But it was a dog called Lollipop who was the great turning point in all of this.
I think when I had done the first part of the work, I braved the busy man Medawar and asked if I could get an interview with him, and his secretary put me straight through to him, and I said, no, don't do that, he's a very busy man. And she said, no, he'd like to speak to you, he was talking about your work. And he was absolutely charming and full of encouragement, and he kindly helped me get a Harkness Fellowship to go to Harvard Medical School and work at the Peter Benn Brigham, where the identical twin transplants had been done some 5 or 6 years before. They gave me wonderful facilities, and we did have a beautiful collie dog called Lollipop, who was a very long survivor with a kidney transplant, and she was presented at the big auditorium at the Brigham as if she was a patient with a kidney graft, and everybody was a bit astounded because they didn't know that there were any patients with kidney grafts that had done well just with treatment with chemicals. And then the resident who presented the case opened the door, and Lollipop bounded into the auditorium and licked all the eminent professors in the front row. And this was a fairly dramatic demonstration that it worked, although it wasn't a patient.
And this was some time after she'd had the transplant.
This was about 6 months or more after the years.
And really, the whole thing started to move quite quickly after that, through the 60s. Did you have the impression you were in a race? Did you feel as if you were, you know, you had rivals across the globe, as it were?
Not quite in that way. I mean, there certainly was a feeling that there were a few people who believed that this would work, and there were a lot of people who believed it wouldn't. And so there was a great stimulus to prove that the doubters were wrong.
Record number four.
Well, record number four is the Dies Irae from Verdi's Requiem, and it was a work that I sang in the chorus at Lansing, where I was a pupil. And in the beautiful Lansing Chapel for the performance, the Royal Marine trumpeters were up in the triforium in the gallery there. It was such a magnificent setting and such a wonderful sound that I'd like to hear that.
Part of the Dies Irae from Verdi's Requiem, played by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. You hold no great brief, I think, Sir Roy Khan, for current methods of running the health service, providers and purchasers. How much damage do you think it's done?
I think it's wasted a hell of a lot of money, because there's some very highly qualified accountants on both the purchasers and the providers' side, and they have a happy game of monopoly discussing what the best price and bargain they can produce. It doesn't do any good. The money's not real. And I think that it has demoralized to a great extent the workers in the health service, who feel that this is irrelevant. I think the health service in the UK and in every country in the world has great troubles reconciling to the new, very expensive high-tech medicine and surgery, including the work that I do myself.
That's the problem, really, isn't it? That there is so much more medicine available to be paid for.
That's right, and I don't think even if we got rid of this present system, wasteful system, I think we would still have this dilemma.
What you get at the moment, I suppose it always has been, but nevertheless we hear a lot of complaints about long waiting lists. Is there any? Do you suffer? How much as a surgeon do you suffer from
Very much. Because of the costs involved and the facilities that are inadequate, we frequently have either no intensive care beds for major surgery or a lack of ordinary beds or a lack of operating facilities in the operating theatres, or not enough anaesthetists to anaesthetise the patient. Very seldom are there not enough surgeons to do the operations.
So you can get the patient in all geared up to be operated on for a major operation, and you've talked to him and everybody's poised for it, and then he's cancelled.
And this is a terrible thing. I mean, apart from the fact that they've got a potentially lethal disease and they're terribly worried and their families are extremely keyed up, to go and tell the patient, well, I'm sorry, we're not going to do the operation today. There's no intensive care bed because it's being filled by some other case.
What's the solution to that dilemma?
One of the troubles is that there is, I believe, too much specialisation in intensive care, and it would be better if nurses had multidisciplinary training in critical care so that they could look after children and adults, head injuries and heart cases, patients who've had just an operation and are recovering but still need critical care.
Of course,
and then
partly,
you could move the nurses around.
It's partly the surgeon's fault that that hasn't happened.
I think it is mainly my profession, and also to some extent the nursing profession, that feel that we are the super specialists and we will only do this, and we don't want any child coming into an adult intensive care ward or vice versa.
And you've got your own little empires and your own nurses.
And this is very much a territorial thing and a vested interest, and I think it'll have to change.
More music.
Well, the next is Dvorak's Symphony from the New World. And this has a special memory for me and my wife, because when I was in the army in Hong Kong, working as a doctor in a Gurkha regiment, my wife, who I'd known when she was a nurse at Guy's, had joined the army as a nurse. And she arrived in a plane in beautiful surroundings of Hong Kong, like a princess from the sky, and the two of us were walking up the hill, and we heard the Dvorak New World Symphony coming from an open window. It was a very beautiful, and still is a beautiful, memory.
Part of Dvorak's Symphony No. 9 in E minor, From the New World, played by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. You hit the headlines 18 months ago, Sir Roy Khan, because you published a book called Too Many People, in which you suggested, among other things, that people should have a license to have children, much as you do to drive a car. It was very controversial and it attracted a lot of critical coverage. I wonder why, I think this is the interesting question, why would a man so eminent in his field plunge headfirst into somebody else's in that way? Why did you do it?
Yes, the license bit was one paragraph, I think, in 200 pages. And I said that we are quite strict in safety regulations for who drives a potentially lethal weapon, namely a car. And perhaps we should also have a similar serious attitude to having children. And that didn't seem to me to be so unreasonable. But the idea of writing a book about this started when I was in Bombay. And I saw some of the population there around the airport. There are about 1 million around the airport, living in terrible poverty. And I went to the children's hospital and they told me that children are brought in dead every day from simple diseases, at least diseases that are easily treated. And then I was just mulling in my own mind of the kind of work that I do, expensive high-tech surgery for a few relatively privileged people. But if I was in charge of the World Health Organization, I would regard most high-tech Western medicine as quite irrelevant, because there's about 1 billion of the 5 billion in the world are living in poverty, close to starvation, and in a state of really a terrible deprivation. That the only thing many of these people do is to procreate children.
But do you
and
really?
And so it became quite an interesting project to do for about 2 years of research.
But do you really believe that we have a moral right to control other people's behaviour, to tell them how they should control their reproductive habits?
If nothing is done, I suspect that we will destroy ourselves, or there will be a major, terrible incident which might clarify our minds. But I wrote this book hoping that the man in the street might read it and find it interesting, but the only thing that the media were interested in is the idea that maybe you needed a license to have children.
There's a double irony, though, here, isn't there? Not just that you spend your life saving lives, but also that you've got 6 children yourself.
That's right. Well, that's before I knew about the world population troubles and the fact that the 5 billion is likely to become 10 billion in the next 20 or 30 years.
Record number 6.
Well, record number 6 is from Carmen, from Bizet's Carmen, in which Carmen mocks and taunts the young soldier, saying, "Wouldn't you rather stay with me?" And he initially says yes, and then he hears the bugle, meaning that he's got to go back to the barracks. And so he's torn between this dilemma of the beautiful girl or the army that's his career.
Carmen, y a tu mamá, arrête.
Et pourquoi, s'il te plaît?
Il me semble là-bas. Oui, c'est son éclairon qui sonne la retraite. Ne laisse pas ta plus grave.
Bravo, bravo, j'avais pour faire. Il est mélancolique de danser sans orchestre. Et vive la musique que nous tombe du ciel.
Teresa Berganza and Placido Domingo and Je vais danser en votre honneur from Bizet's Carmen with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by Claudio Abbado. You're 65 now, Roy Kahn. You've been Professor of Surgery at Addenbrooke's in Cambridge for 30 years. How long can a man go on performing surgery?
I think it depends really on how lucky you are in terms of degeneration of your body and your mind.
Is your hand still steady?
I think it is pretty steady, yes.
He puts it out and has a quick look. But is there a set age for retirement?
In Oxford and Cambridge, professors retire at 67, yes.
It's a fairly arbitrary figure, isn't it? Who says that at 67 you can't do it anymore?
Well, that just happens to be a rule. We're full of rules. In America, they've challenged the rules. They have ageism, so you can't sack professors provided they pass a medical. I think that wouldn't be a bad idea, actually.
How difficult will you find, actually, to give it up?
I would find it very difficult. I hope that I might be able to continue in some way or other, perhaps helping some of my ex-students in developing countries to get transplantation off the ground. But I would hate to have to give up surgery if I was still able to do it.
And in
it's
the
difficult
meantime,
to know whether you're still able to do it. Of course, other people often will tell
to
you.
Find out. In the meantime, you'll carry on plastering the walls of Addenbrooke's with your paintings. You've set quite a trend, haven't you, because your colleagues put their paintings up as well.
Yes, I think that most of the surgeons in Addenbrooke's paint. In fact, doctors are very frequently painters and sculptors, but very few paint their work.
It's not surprising, really, that surgeons like to paint, is it?
No, it's similar. It is similar.
But also, I mean, artists always had to study the anatomy. I mean, there is a link, isn't there?
I would agree with you entirely, and I think that the closeness between, certainly before photography, the closeness between art and medicine, and particularly surgery, where anatomy is so central, has been a close one over the years.
Record number 7.
Record number 7 is another love song, where this time it's the man who is seducing the rather innocent girl, and it's Don Giovanni, another very beautiful song, but it shows how she succumbed to the smooth talk of the handsome Don.
Roger Soyer and Helen Donat singing the duet La Ci Darem La Mano from Mozart's Don Giovanni with the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Daniel Barenboim. Sir Roy Kahn, a surgeon on a desert island, I have this image of a man with a knife in one hand and a paintbrush in the other. If you're not painting or dissecting the fauna, what will you be doing in your solitary confinement?
I will be trying to get to know the animals and plants in the island, to study them and to perhaps make friends with some of them, the animals, that is. If they've got cormorants there, maybe they could do a bit of fishing for me.
And you can cook, can't you?
I can cook fairly specialised dishes. Thai cooking I like doing, but I think I'd have to spread my versatility to rather more simple things like gruel and baked fish.
Let me ask you finally about death, because you're a man who's obviously seen a lot of it at close hand. Does it alter your attitude to death at all? Do you fear it, or do you feel comfortable with it?
Well, I think it does. I do fear it, because it's totally unknown what happens afterwards, although one may have beliefs. The evidence for any afterlife is somewhat thin, but I think that with an idea of the way the human race is really a continuum of its DNA, in a way there is an immortality to the race of beings, not only our species but every species, if we don't destroy it. And perhaps the most important thing is that we don't destroy ourselves for our children's sake and our grandchildren's. But death, if it comes quietly, can be friendly. Often it's very traumatic and horrible, particularly in patients who are kept alive too long by artificial means.
Last record.
Well, the last record actually happens to be a work that a neighbour of mine who played the cello, he had a beautiful Margini cello, he said that this is, for him, the music he would like to hear whilst he was dying, presumably gently, and it is supremely beautiful.
Part of the second movement of Schubert's String Quintet in C major, played by the Kotsian Quartet with Daniel Weiss. If you could only take one of those records, Sir Roy.
I think it would be the Dvorak.
That's memories of climbing the mountain.
That's
with your
right.
wife.
Yes.
And what about your book? You've got the Bible and you've got Shakespeare there already.
Well, I knew what kind of a book I wanted, and I went into Heffers yesterday and had a discussion with the biology department manager, and he suggested a book which looked a very nice one called Global Biodiversity, which would have information on plants and animals, which would be a starting point in trying to classify what was going on in the island in terms of animals and plants. I think that that would be something to work on, as a beginning, any rate.
And what about a luxury?
A luxury would be would have to be paints and canvas, I suppose. I think there's nothing else that I would need so much as that to try and record what was going on.
Sir Roy Kahn, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.